Thank you, members and guests. We will begin very shortly. Thank you. All right, I'll officially call the Ethics and Elections Subcommittee to order. John, would you please call the roll?
Chair Boyd.
Here.
Vice Chair Diaz. Ranking Member Cruz. Representative Ahern. Representative Bikesy. Representative Cullen.
Here.
Representative Edwards. Representative Holder.
Here.
Representative Hooper.
Here.
Representative Peters.
Here.
Representative Rooney.
Here.
Representative Williams. Representative Workman.
Here.
We have quorum.
Thank you, John, and thank you, members. And good afternoon again, and welcome back to the House Ethics and Elections Subcommittee. Today, we will continue our important task of examining Florida's ethics and election laws. First, today, we're going to hear a presentation from the Florida Commission on Ethics, followed by public testimony on both ethics and elections reform. We'll also have some further chances for public testimony in our first meetings in February as well. So today, if you could, during the first presentation, if you hold your questions until the end of that presentation, as you've been doing so far, I think that would be great. And then we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers after the presentation. Also, if anyone in the audience that hasn't brought a card up wishes to speak and provide public testimony, please fill out an appearance card and get it up here to us so we can make sure we allow everyone that wants the opportunity to speak today to have that chance. So we do have some already in hand, but any of those that haven't done that, please do that now. Okay. Any questions, members, before we get started? Seeing none. Today we will hear from Verlindia, I think I said that right, Verlindia Doss, who is the Executive Director of the Florida Commission on Ethics. Ms. Doss will be presenting an overview on the commission, as well as being able to answer questions at the end, and the 2013 legislative priorities that they have. So, Ms. Doss, I hope I didn't butcher your name too bad to begin with, and thank you so much for being here, and you may proceed.
Actually, you did remarkably well. I'm Verlindia Doss. I'm the Executive Director of the Florida Commission on Ethics, and I thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to be here to speak with you today. I really appreciate your interest, and I have to tell you that the Commission, my members, are so gratified to see all the interest in ethics reform and ethics legislation this year. And I also have to tell you, I want to thank your very excellent committee staff, which serves you very well and has been very attentive and is very knowledgeable with respect to these issues. So what I want to use this time to do is to briefly introduce you to the Ethics Commission, what it is, what we do, and how we do it, and to share with you some of the things we hope you will be considering during this upcoming legislative session. As you know, our commission is the independent commission called for in the Florida Constitution to investigate and report on allegations of breach of the public trust by public officers and employees. The commission is a 9-member body. Your speaker appoints 2 members, the Senate president appoints 2, and the governor appoints 5. I'm very proud to say there has never been any evidence of partisanship on the commission. We don't have those kind of 5-4 split votes you hear about in the federal system sometimes. The Commission gets most of the attention for its investigations, and of course that is our constitutional mandate, but we also perform the more unsung but I'm sure much more appreciated task of providing information and advice and helping people understand and navigate the ethics laws through our advisory opinions. I or someone in my office has probably talked to either you or someone on your staff in the last year. We did 21 formal opinions in 2012. Staff wrote 145 informal letters of advice, and we've taken hundreds of phone calls. We have an attorney on call every day to respond to questions from the public and public officers and employees. In addition to that, we administer the financial disclosure laws for almost 37,000 filers, 16,000 of whom file with our office, and we administer the executive branch lobby registration program, and we do this with 23.5 people. In doing all this, the Commission sees hundreds of real-life, day-to-day instances that people have questions, problems, and it becomes aware of areas where the law needs tightening up, strengthening, or updating. Since it's one of the statutory responsibilities of the Commission to report to you any recommendations for legislation that it has, we bring to the House and Senate our legislative proposals just about every year. Now, there are many, many ideas percolating out there regarding ethics legislation. That's a very hot topic this year. For years, we've kind of lived in ignominy, but this year is ethics year. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of some of the ideas that the Ethics Commission has put forward. And you will probably be relieved to know I'm not going to recite the entire package to you, because a lot of it really involves the in-the-weeds, gap-filler kind of things that is very useful to us, but it does not have a lot of, real excitement for people outside the business. And I'm sure you would never let me approach the podium again if I went through our recommendations one by one. I have provided your staff with the Commission's recommendations, and I see that they're in your packet. They'll also be contained in the Commission's annual report, which my Commission is meeting on Friday this week, and will vote on its annual report for submission to the legislature. But I'm going to just hit the major points here. Number one priority for us deals with the collection of fines for people who have failed to timely file their financial disclosure and subsequently accrued a fine through the operation of law. Just to give you some background, if you don't file your financial disclosure on time, this applies to you as well as all disclosure filers, you automatically receive by operation of law a $25 per day fine for every day late, to a maximum of $1,500. This law was enacted in 2000 to increase compliance with the disclosure law, and it worked beautifully. We went from 92% compliance to 99% compliance almost within the next year. We shot up. Under the law, people who don't pay their fines are sent to DFS, the Department of Financial Services, for assignment to a collection agency, and that's essentially where the system has broken down. The collection agencies have not been able to make collections on many of the fines, and nobody knew about it until, or let me just say, the Ethics Commission didn't know about it until 2010, when another law was passed that said the agencies had to report on their outstanding debt. At that time, we found out there were thousands and thousands of dollars in fines that not only had not been collected, but could not be collected because the statute of limitations has run. Now, the Commission is not a collection agency, and in all candor, we don't want to be. We don't have the staff or the expertise in that area, and we're a legislative branch agency. But the Commission is extremely concerned that there's no leverage to incentivize people who have these fines to pay. So it is proposed that we be able to record our orders on these fines as a lien on real property, just like you would record a judgment. And that would give, you know, people would have to pay their fine so that they could clear that lien ultimately if they wanted to sell the property. Representative Charles McBurney has sponsored a bill, House Bill 287, which would do that. I know there's also conversation and discussion in the Senate, and the Senate Bill 2 that they passed yesterday, dealing with garnishing wages. There's also conversation about taking delinquent filers to court to recover the fines, the way the Attorney General's office does with our cases that are based on complaints being filed. And the Commission is working with all of those various entities to see what can be accomplished in that regard. But that is our number one priority this year, to get something done about those delinquent filers. In addition, We have an issue regarding referrals. Now, in the past, and indeed this year, the Commission has recommended that it be given the ability to initiate its own investigations. And that really has never gotten a lot of traction, and I understand there are policy arguments pro and con on that. But something that it has also recommended and that has gotten more attention and interest from a lot of quarters is the ability to accept referrals from other agencies, specifically state attorneys, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the governor, the CFO, and I think in the Senate bill they also included U.S. attorneys. That would allow those entities in cases where they didn't think they could prove to a beyond a reasonable doubt or for some other reason they couldn't make the case, they could refer to us if it looked like there was a violation of the ethics law. And Representative McBurney's bill also contains this concept. In addition, the Commission has recommended that our penalty range be increased. Currently, the maximum penalty that can be imposed, and of course we don't impose it because we're a legislative branch agency, but the maximum penalty that we can recommend is $10,000 per violation. That's usually plenty in most cases, but every now and then you come across a case where a $10,000 penalty is really no more than a cost of doing business for the violator, and so they feel like they would like the ability to go up to $25,000. There is also some interest in the voting conflicts law. As it stands now, there are a number of different voting conflict requirements for various public officers. The Commission's proposal would essentially simplify it to two. Local appointed officials, local elected officials, and state-level appointed officials who have a voting conflict of interest would have to abstain from the vote and from any participation in the discussion. They'd have to announce their conflict, and they'd have to file a voting conflict memorandum. Under the Commission's proposal, the standard would be the same for state. I'm sorry, the standard would stay as it is for state elected officials, such as yourself. In other words, the standard would not change for members of the legislature. You would still be able to participate, still be able to vote, and would only be required to file the conflict memorandum just as you are now. Representative McBurney has also included this proposal in his bill, and I believe it's also in House Bill 233, bill filed by Representative Fasano. And finally, blind trusts. The Commission has recommended that there be a provision that would allow a safe harbor from the conflict and voting conflict laws for officials who put their assets in a blind trust. Now, the trade-off for this protection, which would be substantial, would be that there would be a number of requirements that would have to be attached to the blind trust. For example, the person would have to say what's going into the trust when they start it, so the public would be aware of that, would have to say what's come out of the trust if they revoke it. You could only put assets in the trust that were readily marketable, so you couldn't kind of stick something in there that you know would never be sold. And there would be limitations on who the trustee could be and what information they could share with the trust beneficiary. If it's done correctly, the blind trust could be extremely helpful to high-wealth officials with complicated financial pictures. It would relieve them from the burden of having to think every time they have a vote, okay, let me go through my entire portfolio in my head and make sure I'm not going to be benefiting one of these companies while still protecting the public. And I believe Representative Fasano's bill incorporates the Commission's proposal in that regard as well. As I said, the Commission has a number of other recommendations, although not as dramatic as these. I just listed the top few. And I would be more than glad to spend the rest of the afternoon going through each and every one of them until you begged me to stop. But having hit the high points, I know that you have a great deal of important work to do. So I will stop here and thank you for your time and be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Ms. Doss, first, thanks very much for your presentation, and thank you for your ideas and suggestions as well. We'll take those very seriously as we continue this process, and we do appreciate your input. You all are on the front lines every day, so what you bring to us is very valuable and useful information. And thank you as well for boiling it down to these. I know you're certainly capable of answering and going on a lot of these. But with that, we'll stop and ask members that might have specific questions they would like to ask you to have that opportunity now. So, members, yes, Representative Clellan, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Doss, for that presentation. You mentioned early on that in collecting these fines that sometimes you weren't able to because the statute had run. What is the statute of limitations period? I haven't looked through the documents.
Chair?
You're recognized.
It's 4 years.
Okay. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Next, Vice Chair Diaz, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. The first is I had a local elected official from back home tell me that sometimes when somebody files a memorandum of voting conflict, it's used against them even though they're doing what they're supposed to do based on the rules. Do you have any heartburn about maybe just changing the name to, like, memorandum of recusal, which is really what's happening, so that somebody doesn't attack them and say, look at all these conflicts the person has? That's the first question. And the second question is, I know that the Senate has incorporated some of your recommendations into their initial package is already starting to move. What, if any, worries you have about what they recommended or haven't recommended based on the package that you guys have proposed? Those were my two questions.
Thank you, Ms. Doss. You're recognized.
I don't think it really makes a difference what you call a piece of paper. What the person is doing is relating the reasons why they can't vote. Now, part of our proposals do include that you need to fully state the reason for your conflict. For example, there have been cases where the person stands to benefit to a very significant amount, and they have a relative who also stands to get that much benefit. So they'll put on the voting conflict form, my relative stands to benefit, that's why I'm not voting. And the public never realizes that the voting individual actually stands to gain a lot. So we have recommended that they be required to fully explain. But I don't think it makes any difference what it's called. And I'll keep that in mind to see if potentially we could change the name of the form via a rule. With respect to the Senate bill, there are many things in it that are good. One of the things is it extends the statute of limitations to 20 years. So that would be a significant benefit. It addresses the fine issue in a slightly different way. It would allow the filing of liens on real property. It also speaks to garnishment. There's a little, just from a practical viewpoint, it's a little unclear to me who would actually be enforcing the garnishment. I don't really mind the notion of the Ethics Commission going to court and taking these people, but it's not really what I really see as our mission. And, of course, we are a legislative branch agency. It sounds a little executive, but we don't have any expertise in that area. One of the other things that is in the Senate bill that is that I think is a very new concept is restrictions on legislators voting that would place them under, if the vote would benefit them personally. I think there's an abstention requirement in there. That's not something the Ethics Commission has recommended. It doesn't have a position on it. You have to understand, for me to represent that the Ethics Commission has a position, they have to have considered it in an open and public meeting and have a position on it. It's not just whatever their executive director thinks is a good idea or a bad idea. But they have incorporated a number of proposals that the Ethics Commission has made, a number of their own proposals. There's plenty of good in there. There's some things that I think could use a little bit of tweaking, but we'll work. They've been really open about working with us. We've spent many hours with their staff, and I think they will continue to work with us through the process.
Thank you. Follow up? Good. Members, other questions of Ms. Doss? Okay, seeing none, again, thank you for your working with our staff, as you said earlier, and we look forward to continuing to work together as we move towards some substantive reform here. So thank you very much, and appreciate you taking time to be here today.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, members, now we're going to move into public testimony. I'll remind the public again in case you came in after we began the meeting. If you would like to speak, we would love to hear from you. Please fill out a card and get it up here to us, and we'll make sure that we recognize everybody that wants to speak. We're going to try to do this in two sections. First, we're going to have members of the public that want to speak on ethics reform, and then the second segment will be on elections. So if you kind of keep that in mind as you're coming to the podium, I would appreciate that. And first, we have Mr. Brian Pitts, who wants to speak on ethics reform, I believe. Mr. Pitts, are you here? There you are. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you very much, Brian Pitts, Justice Jesus on the measure. If you haven't got a whiff on the Senate side, what has went down, peekaboo, it's time for you. And, you'll be dealing with it. They'll send their package over, however it fall, whatever leadership do. I mean, as I said, you know, from a social standpoint, if leadership wanted to do this, their name should be on the bill. And this is what I mean. Herodopoulos, many times, bills he was interested in, remember, he put his name on the Dillon bill, the health bill. But unfortunately, it makes you want to think how serious. But getting back to it, what's all done with ethics? Now, Commissioner Ethics came before you. Now, let's make this very clear. They deal with the ethics concerning local government, legislative entities that are created by you, legislative and executive. Is that all the public officials? Who they don't deal with? Judiciary. Those two are public officials. So when they made their broad statement, I want to correct this. Well, that's kind of nitpicking. No, let's be straight. They do not deal with judiciary. And it's very questionable if they can really deal with judicial employees. So you may want to think about that. Now, 2088 Senate Bill, 2011 session. Some were here that you know about that. Senate did a very good package on ethics. They decided not to bring that back. I'm telling you that for a reason, because you don't have to do what they do. Whoever want to do it right, do it. Y'all can do it, or you can play around like they have in their particular bill. The main issue around ethics came because of the what? Statewide grand jury reports. In those reports, it mentions, in collaboration with the legislature and the Commission on Ethics, the legislature in conjunction with the Commission on Ethics, the state attorney in conjunction with the Commission on... And if you read throughout the recommendations, the last report done in December of 2010 constantly mentions Commission on Ethics. It does. So some of the recommendations that she spoke today are in that report. But remember, that report is the people speaking to you, not just the Commission on Ethics. So the first thing you need to be thinking about today, though no one has said it, is what did the people say in some of our very districts who voted for us today? What does those reports say? Remember the Bush report of 2000, when he put that commission together, then the report of 2009, then the report of 2010, all state grand juries. The commission, of course, by Bush in 2000 was something different. All of them, they'll say the same thing. This is the people telling you, this is what we want you to do. When are you going to make this bill straightening up the act? Remember, we're number one in corruption. We continue to go. The feds have no problem having a field day with us. One of you one day, even if you don't watch it. Now, this is what I'm saying to you. If you want to start with anything, start with the 127-page report, the 9th statewide grand jury. That's what it's about. That's what it's about. Why won't you? Okay, and I understand why you won't. Because in there, why? They mentioned many times you must add a criminal component to the Code of Ethics. You must add stiffer guidelines for the criminal component of Florida Statute 838 and 839. Y'all don't want to do it. You need to hear what the people said to you. Do it. Go grab 2088 from 2011 Senate bill and start that as a template. I told the Senate that. They decided not to. Matter of fact, in the Senate bill, there is no criminal component anywhere. At least in the 2088 bill, there was criminal component. Ryzen, well, you can keep talking about this. This is what the people told you to do in three different reports. That's the point I'm making. If you say we're here for the people and we want to do what's right, then get the reports. Y'all should have them today. Saying this is what we're going to do. We don't need any ideas. My fact, Commission of Ethics, your ideas are in here too, because they are. Here's another issue that is not dealt with. your powers and duties and your true salaries. Go look at Florida Statute 11.13. Florida Statute 11.13. It says that you make, as normal members, $18,000. You don't make $18,000. You make $29,000. And leadership does not make 25, they make about 41, 42. Well, why is this significant? From an ethics standpoint, the courts have ruled a officer shall make no more than what is written in law. That's what case law says. That's an ethics issue. If you gave them authority to pursue you, the legislator members, for not doing your powers and duties, okay, oh, now see, now I'm treading water now here. Y'all definitely ain't going to do something like that. Well, right now, y'all have unbridled discretion to do whatever you want, whereas the Constitution says your powers and duties and compensation shall be fixed as by law. That's an ethics issue that y'all need to straighten out. That's not even in the statewide grand jury report, nor the Commission on Ethics, but they need authority to pursue you. Y'all telling them what to do in statute. You're going to tell somebody how to prosecute you. How y'all going to do it? I wish you the best on this project. The last point now that I will make is now the judiciary. It's the Judicial Qualifications Commission. That's who's supposed to deal with the ethics. Okay, go talk to Nathan Bond. You know, he's still here. Go talk to Nathan Bond. And this is why. In 2008, when the House used to do interim projects, they did a massive, extensive report. And they found out that the JQC wasn't doing at all what they were supposed to do. It was a smokescreen. They got scared, didn't do anything, no policy, nothing. Thurston is still here, you can ask him. Soto, of course, now is a senator. But Ambler is also gone. But some members who were on that, McBurney also was on that committee, are still here. When you talk about full-fledged ethics, as you talk about to the media, okay, and other watchdogs in D.C., even Florida Integrity, Integrity Florida, you also have to deal with the ethical component of the judges and their employees. The JQC, save yourself $900,000. And that's what I'm saying to you. You need another proposal, as I told the Senate. And the only way to do this is you have to make a resolution removing the JQC and putting their powers and duties in the Commission on Ethics. That way, it's two things happen. You save yourself $900,000 to $1,000,000 because that's what you're wasting on them right now. And also, you finally have a different check on the judiciary because all the check you got right now is bleeding them for money. That's the only way you really can check them. Well, at least if you put them in the ethical component, the Commission on Ethics, you have somewhat of a check of balance because right now you don't. So right now, that'll all share with you. I'll see what kind of bill you come up with. Hopefully you can look at that grand wide jury report and really get busy and serious and deal with the judiciary ethics. Keep that in mind. Thank you much. I know that was long, but I wanted to help you a little bit.
Always appreciate your help, Mr. Pitts. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you back. There's a question for Mr. Pitts.
Yes.
Representative Williams, you're recognized.
This might be a joke.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Mr. Pitts, thank you for your testimony. Can you provide us with your recommendations, sort of like what we got from the... can you give us a... Cliff Notes version of your recommendations that you think we should implement into this bill?
It will be long, but
chair?
I do have a package I can give to you. But unless you want me to explain it to you right now, but yes, I do have a package.
The package will be fine.
Package will be great.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'll recognize Mr. Ben Wilcox to speak on ethics from the League of Women Voters. Mr. Wilcox, thank you for being here, and you're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Boyd and members of the committee. I'm Ben Wilcox, representing the League of Women Voters of Florida. The League would like to thank House Speaker Weatherford and the committee for making ethics reform a priority this year. We recognize that you can't necessarily legislate morality, but I do think there are things you can do that can help create a culture that's more conducive to ethical behavior. We'd just like to offer to work with you as you bring legislation forward and support your efforts to move it through the process. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And we do welcome your input and your ideas as well and those of the League. So thank you very much. And we'll look forward to working with you as we move along.
Great.
I think you're going to come back in a minute and talk about elections. Or
yes.
Okay. So if you'll just let us... I think we have one more speaker right now on the ethics component, and then we'll get to elections. So thank you, sir. Mr. Dan Krasner, who is with Integrity of Florida. We heard from you the other day, sir. Welcome back, and you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Great to be back with you. Integrity Florida did also publish over the summer reports specifically on ethics reform. I just want to make sure everyone received them. Some of the new members, we try to make sure we have all your email addresses. But if you have any questions for us, if we can be a research resource for you on ethics reform specifically, separate from the campaign finance reform discussion, we'd be happy to help. There's been an important national report card to take a look at stateintegrity.org/Florida. Where Florida received a failing grade for ethics enforcement. And I would just want to say that that grade doesn't reflect the great team you have at the Florida Commission on Ethics. They do a great job with the mission they have and the tools they have in their toolkit. And our research is pointing for towards ways to help that great commission achieve an A grade. And the legislature has the authority to provide those tools to help Florida compete nationally on those on the integrity indexes. So we're here to support your work to help Florida be known nationally as a leader for ethics reform, and happy to take any questions and be available to you as a research resource.
Thank you, sir. And also, members, if you don't have Mr. Krasner's work or report, staff can help you get that, or you can feel free to give him your email before he leaves today as well.
Sure.
And we look forward to continuing our dialogue with you as we move through the process. So thank you. Thank you for
thank
what you bring
Chairman.
To us. Okay. Yes, sir. Any? Oh, yes, sir. We have a card coming up. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Doolin. I represent two organizations of local elected officials, the Small School District Consortium, which deals with school board members and superintendents in school boards with 24,000 students or less, and the Small County Coalition, which is a group of county commissioners of 150,000 or less. The first thing we do with new elected officials anytime we meet with them is ethics laws and regulations, and we have folks come in and talk to them about that. It's absolutely essential. We don't want anybody getting in any trouble, and it's very complicated, as you all well know. It'd be one of the things that I did want to offer, and Ben Gate, you know, just watching Mr. Wilcox, I wanted to say we want to work very closely with this process. There are unintended consequences, not specifically on, well, for instance, there was a provision, dual public employment in the Senate bill yesterday, and we're still looking at that issue. But in rural counties, you have individuals that grow up, become teachers, become public works, become secretaries, and because of wanting to stay in those rural areas, they also become elected officials on school boards or county commissions. These are not full-time jobs, although you would think that they were once you take an elected position. But I would caution and want to work with the House side, and I'll continue to work on the Senate side, on limitations of future employment restrictions. There's some language in the Senate bill that concern me that people in current employed positions that serve on these commissions or school boards would be restricted of ever changing that job in any regard. And I could go into detail, which I won't do, but I just want to say that there are unintended consequences that we might not be able to intend. So I want to work with that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Doolin. I believe we have one question. Representative Williams, you're right.
Thank you. And Mr. Doolin, I'm glad you brought this point up. We dealt with some of this, I believe, when Bruce Chairman Rob Schenck was carrying a double-dipping bill on FRS. And maybe you can help us, because one of the things that came up was I had a constituent who was a city commissioner but also was on FRS, had retired, and because of stipulations within that bill and within the law, it said that he could not, he almost had to forfeit his pension in order to go and be an elected official. He had served 30-odd years in the community doing great work, and folks didn't really want him to step down. He knew he had to retire, but they wanted him to do more now that he was retired. Any suggestions? I know some of this is federal, and since that IRS says that, you know, there's some certain stipulations within the federal code that don't allow us to do this, but is there anything that you can provide to us today by way of testimony that can help us alleviate that problem or petition the federal government to hopefully make some changes. I'm sure if it's impacting Florida, it's got to be impacting other states around the union.
Thank you, Representative Williams. I don't want to disappoint you, but I have no suggestions today. I'd be glad to look at the issue and rather than, but I wanted to specifically talk about this issue. There are a couple telling examples that I could use, but I won't. It's just really fairness issues. So I'd like to work with you on the employment issues to avoid unintended consequences. I know those similar exists in larger counties, but in these smaller rural areas, the professional capacity of leadership, and these positions should be open to everybody, and they are through employment that are transparent, accountable, they're accountable to the public as well. So thank you very much. Appreciate
Look forward to hearing from you. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Williams.
Thank you.
Hey, anyone else care to provide public testimony on ethics, the ethics component that hasn't been able to speak yet? All right, seeing none, we'll move into public testimony on elections. And first we have Mr. Ben Wilcox, again with the League of Women Voters, on elections. So give you time to get up. Don't break your ankle jumping up there. But thank you very much again for being here.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I'll be brief. We have submitted a letter to staff from our state president, Deirdre McNabb. And in the letter, we outlined the league's recommendations for election reform. I'll just kind of sum up five broad categories that we identified. One would be to improve the early voting process. Two, to modernize Florida's voter registration system. Three, to reform the absentee ballot process. Four, to restrict the length of constitutional ballot amendment summaries. And five, to address mobility and safety concerns for voters who are disabled or elderly. And again, the more specific recommendations are in the letter, which I won't go into at the time, but be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. And we did receive that, and I know we're factoring that and analyzing that as we move forward as well. So any input along the way that additional that you'd like to provide, we'd be happy to meet with you and talk about. But thank you for that. Any questions, members of Mr. Wilcox? Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you being here. We don't have any other public testimony cards on elections. Is there anyone? Wait, we do, but we're getting one now. Ms. Gail Perry and Communication Workers of America, Council of Florida. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Welcome, Ms. Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've been a volunteer voter registrar since 1976 in our great state of Florida, and I have to say that for the last few pieces of legislation, I have all but stopped doing voter registration, afraid that I'd forget to cross a T or ask the person for their phone number. As a matter of fact, in this last election cycle, I only had one local that teamed up with the Sierra Club that did any type of voter registration. We used to do it at our meetings, at our, you know, 4th of July parties, and so we would like to make sure you try and straighten that out so that little groups like myself, I am just a citizen. My family's been involved in freedom and justice for all since 1635 in this great country. So I've been doing that since I was able to vote. Let me tell you about a couple things that happened in my county and in the state during this election cycle, because I am very active, and I have the ability to talk to members all over the state to see what's happening in the area. I got a call before the election from one of my people in Washington County, and they were going to have a very big problem on election day. And I want to give kudos to the Secretary of State, because the office, once I finally got to talk with someone, they said they would call, handle the problem, and call me back as soon as it was handled. And within 15 minutes, I got a call back and it was handled. And it avoided a big problem on Election Day. So I really appreciate that ability to speak with someone that could be handling problems. I was here in 2000 and heard problems from 9 in the morning on. So it was really wonderful to make one phone call and get someone to help me. I appreciate that. I think the one thing that I have to say about Election Day, I usually do a varied jobs on Election Day, and this year I drove people to the polls, and I had a couple of handicapped people, and that really needs to be taken a good look at during these negotiations. They did have a little bit of problems. There's no community voting site anymore. I think maybe if you could give a little bit more choice to the supervisor of elections in each county on where their locations are, where they can have early voting, where they can have their polling sites. I know I'm from a very big area, so our rural areas are just as important as our big areas, and we need to make sure that they have the ability to put the sites where the most people can go and vote or early vote. We also believe, after myself standing in the line for 3 hours before Election Day, there were lines for 5 and 6 hours in the county that I'm from, and hearing all over the state. So if you would give some flexibility to the supervisors of elections, you know, they have to meet the expectations of their constituents within the county. So it really would be good if you would give them some flexibility on how they treat the elections, on early voting, and also on the handicapped issues. We appreciate everything that you're going to be looking at, both on the ethics and the election side, and we hold ourselves open for any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Perry. And we've heard some of those similar concerns from some of the supervisors that were in last week in testimony as well. So a lot of what you said is consistent with some of the things we've heard. But thank you for bringing that to us and giving us your thoughts and ideas. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. All righty. Is there anyone else in the... Yes, there is. Ms. Kunkel with America Votes.
Yes, thank
you. Welcome,
and
you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Kunkel, and I'm working with America Votes. For those of you who don't know, America Votes is a national organization that works locally in the states across the nation. And we work on a multitude of issues, including ballot initiatives, issue-based campaigns, and then also on election reform. And so we will echo the sentiments of the other folks who have testified here today and say that we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and with the members on elections reform as we move forward. We're also very excited that this body has chosen to work on both ethics and elections reform in this cycle. We have 5 recommendations for the committee to look at as we move into elections reform. The first is returning the number of early voting days back to 14 days. Even though we saw long lines in 2008, we saw much longer lines in 2012, and we think returning it back to 14 days would be helpful to alleviate some of those long lines. In addition to that, we'd also like to see the committee put in a standard of 12 hours of early voting each day. We know that everyone in Florida doesn't have the luxury of working a 9-to-5 job. Some of us work two jobs a day. Some of us work non-traditional hours. Many of you, like us, work 12 and 15-hour days, and so we believe a 12-hour early voting day, including the weekends, would be helpful to ensure that people can vote when it is most convenient for them. In addition to that, we'd like to see the flexibilities of the supervisor of elections in choosing their early voting sites consistent with election day sites. We'd like to limit the number of words in the constitutional ballot initiatives to 75 words. And then we'd also would like to see voters be able to have portability when it comes to updating their voter address on election day. Prior to 2011's House Bill 1355, voters, when they moved across the county, were able to update their voter registration on election day. With the changes, we saw a vast number of voters having to cast provisional ballots in the 2012 elections. We think if a voter is registered in the state of Florida and they move from one county to another, they should be able to update their voter registration on election day. So those are some of our recommendations. I don't want to take much of the committee's time, but we do look forward to working with you all as the election package comes out of this committee and as it moves forward to the full body. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kunkel. Good to see you again, and thank you for your recommendations. Representative Workman, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Just two quick questions. You mentioned the long lines in 2012 and you referenced 2008. Do you think the long lines had anything to do with the 2- and 3-page ballots that we had versus the number of early voting days?
You recognize Ms. Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a multitude of issues resulted in the long lines. Certainly the length of the ballot, which is one of the reasons why we've recommended limiting the number of words on the Constitution to 75. I think it also had to do with the limited number of sites and the limited number of days that voters were allowed to vote.
Thank you. Second question.
Yes, sir.
And I was going to write it down, and I didn't, and now I'm having a hard time pulling it up. What was the last thing you spoke about? I wanted to ask you about that. Do you remember before? That's not my question, by the way. But
that was the changing of address on voting
yes,
day.
Yes, thank you. Well done, Mr. Chairman.
I'm smart like that. Oof, you're recognized.
Wow, that's why you're the chairman. The reason that was changed, in my opinion, was if you move from one county, if you're registered in, say, my home county, Brevard, and you move to Volusia, the poll worker has no way of knowing if you voted in your old precinct when you left there that morning and went to or with early voting. You know, you have several days you could vote. Provisional ballots count. Why do we not want to preserve the integrity of the vote and make sure that if your license or your address is not the same on your voter card, that you just go ahead and file that provisional. We can count those after the fact, but my concern is voter fraud, number one, and I think you have the same concern. Why open that door to voter fraud when you could have somebody vote twice and all we're doing is saying, just in case you might have, because that poll worker has no way of knowing, we're going to have you file that provisional ballot. Don't you see an issue there?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely agree with you. We want to be able to curb down any kind of voter fraud that's happening in the state of Florida. I think one way that we can definitely look at addressing voter fraud, and I know some of our supervisors of elections mentioned this last week in both the Senate and the House, was the use of updated electronic equipment, including electronic poll books. The point here that we're trying to make on why we should be allowing portability for voters when they're updating their address across when they move from one county to another was that the supervisors of elections have mentioned that the number of provisional ballots that were cast during the 2012 elections were increased because of that change in law. And this would help to alleviate, or at least in our opinion, it would help to alleviate the number of provisional ballots that are being cast and the amount of work that is being added to the supervisors of elections as well as to their staff to have to go in, validate provisional ballots, and then count those. The other thing that we heard multiple times mentioned by supervisors of elections last week was that Florida continued to report very late, well past the national news cycles. This might help for if every person is casting a ballot that is a regular ballot and not a provisional ballot, we might have those numbers coming in much more quickly, especially when we start to look at, you know, House and Senate races that are being decided by very narrow margins. So, again, our concern is making it easier for the voter to cast a vote on Election Day and alleviating some of the burden on the SOEs and the staff.
Follow up, sir?
Yes, sir. Quick follow-up. It's one thing to want to make it easier on the voter. I think we all agree that we want to make sure that it's as easy as possible to vote in this state. It's another thing to open the door to fraudulent voters. We had 62, 63 counties done like this, and we were late on just a few. And we're going to try to look at that in this committee and see what happened in those few counties that did so poorly. My question to you is, and this is your opinion, is the desire to not have provisional ballots, does that outweigh the need to make sure that every vote is valid and real and not duplicative, not fraudulent? Do we want to rush the system so much that we don't care who votes, or we don't care if you vote twice, or do we want to make sure they're valid, or do we want to make sure people don't vote a provisional ballot, which is a legitimate ballot? Sometimes we speak as if provisionals don't count. They do count, and I know you know that. So what's more important, that the vote is correct and counted, or that somebody is able to vote twice, or the Pandora's box is opened?
Ms. Kunkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely think that we want to do a combination of both. We certainly can all agree that we do not want any election fraud in the state of Florida. But I think we have to make sure that we're doing things so that in an election process that is easier on the not only the staff who are conducting the elections, but also on the voter themselves. And so, Representative Workman, I would love to come and talk with you more about ways that we can help alleviate on both sides of the staff as well as the voter. Maybe it isn't provisional issues. Maybe it is provisional, but I'd love to work with you more on that.
I'm sure he would welcome that. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We have Dana Farmer. Is that correct? Farmer with the Disability Rights Florida. Welcome, Ms. Farmer. You're recognized.
Thank you. I really wanted to thank you for looking at this issue closely. As the designated protection and advocacy agency in Florida, on Elections Day and in early voting, we were part of a national hotline, and we received phone calls from voters with disabilities in Florida. And the thing I wanted to talk to you today is the issue that's come up several times about the lines. We have some observations about the lines from what people called and told us that I wanted to share with you. A couple of things. If you are a person with a disability and you need the accessible parking place, and the lines are long, when you pull up, if those accessible parking places are already full and people are in long lines, they don't turn over. And there are far more, you know, regular parking spaces than there are accessible. So that was a problem we were hearing. People were pulling up, they watched the accessible places for a little while, and when they didn't turn over, they left. In a lot of places, what we were hearing was that they were actually using what I think the supervisors referred to as a ticketed system. Say if I was a person with a disability and I had an obvious, a visible disability, like I used a wheelchair or an assistive device to walk with, for example, I would be told that there was a ticketed system. Somehow I'd get a number, someone else would get a number in line, and they would let me go sit at the front of the line to wait to vote. And when my place got up to the top, I would then get in the line and vote. The issue with that is that people that had disabilities that were not visible, for example, diabetes, heart concerns, that could not stay in a line for a long time, they often didn't hear about that. We were very unclear if there was any signage period telling people about accommodations you could get if you couldn't stand in line. And we remain kind of unclear about that and are trying to find it out. So we would suggest that there be signage. Another thing that we don't have a clear handle on is the SOEs in advance when they're doing, you know, interviews with the paper and sending out mail, et cetera, are they telling people about how to ask for an accommodation in the line? So that's another issue that we ran into. A lot of the times when we heard these things, we could call the SOEs and they could straighten out the particular issue at the particular early voting site or precinct. But in general, those would be some recommendations going forward. We do intend to bring you some written recommendations as well and look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Farmer, and thank you for the service you provide the voters.
Pleasure.
All righty. Mr. Pitts, did you submit another card, sir?
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
Okay. On elections reform?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you very much, Brian Pitts. Just easy enough. I was going to sit this one out, but I guess that's what happens when things kind of linger on. I almost forgot about this from a personal standpoint. JGJ has his own political committee, and from standpoint of elections, there's some problems internally. But here's the first thing we can start out. Go get the HB. I forgot what laws of Florida is now. But you know what Representative Baxley did, that elections reform. 1355? Just go ahead and get the bill and look at what you need to repeal in it. We can start right there. Because that's what caused the problem today. in this last election. Things y'all made in that long bill. Just go back to the bill and say, oh, we made a couple mistakes. Baxley, you did it. Come on, let's go. Hey, come on. Let's find what we need to repeal in it. Start right there. Because that's what it stems from. When you get voting rights, the right to vote should not be that easy. Remember, that's a constitutional right, so it should be least restrictive. What you did in the bill was not the least restrictive. It was sabotage. Use the aspect of fraud, as one of the members brought up. Well, media and other think tanks have done it and went through different states and found out what the GOP was talking about concerning fraud. Doesn't exist. And what is so minuscule and diminished is of no substance of magnitude. Many, so not just liberal media, but many entities. I'm sure you saw some media reports and some things that come out. We've went through the summer and now come to this new year. They felt it really doesn't. Even the ACLU weighed in on it and says, we thought it might exist. It exists maybe a little bit in the mail-in ballots. That's the best they found, the mail-in ballots. And that was questionable. It stems from that 1355 bill. Go get it, look at it, and see what you need to repeal. That's the starter. Okay, now, the EFS filing system. So now we're talking about something internally. Okay, the only way you can lock into that thing is you have to everything in or pay somebody or pay for the program. Wait a minute, what if you got a very poor political committee? Because remember, political committees have to use that same EFS filing system. That thing is messed up. Why can't I use a simple Microsoft spreadsheet or Excel, something like that, punch it all in at one time, and then boom, upload it. Y'all got it, Division of Elections, that's it. Because remember, y'all got rid of the paper, so you can't do paper. I had a little argument feud with him, and it's kind of conflicting language. It says it can only be done by electronic system, but then other language in the statute says, no, you can do it by paper also. You know, the old-fashioned way it used to be done by paper. Make up your mind if it can be done by paper or it must be done by the EFS filing system. Not only that, why must I have to pay someone to do it who has the software or pay for the software, which is expensive in the range of $300 to $500, to do it, or sit there for hours, especially if you get a lot of contributions, and type in everything. Because remember, you have to do every slot, the money, and if it's over the 100, you have to put in their occupation, all that, then go to the next screen, then put all that, the address, the phone. Guys, why can't I just use Microsoft spreadsheet and done, upload it, and that's it? Why make it so difficult? Why? Because the next thing comes. Remember, it don't take much to violate by one day, and you start getting fined. Now, y'all know because y'all have to use the same system when you do your elections or your campaign manager has to do it. I mean, your treasurer has to do it between the two. It shouldn't be so difficult for a political committee to do it as well. It is. So many political committees have went out of business, that is the low-budget ones, you know, the poor ones, or they just stopped using it because you're going to get fined and get violated. Now it brings us to the next issue you need to look at. You need to have a presentation done by them, Florida Elections Commission. They ain't running a tight ship either. They didn't even follow their own administrative rules. That is for those they have made rules for. Some of the things that they do is based on prior orders. If you understand the Administrative Procedures Act, if you have a substantive rule, it must be made in the AFC, promulgated. You know, if that's like any other agency, they must go through a notice, a hearing, public comment, and everything. They have things that they're using that's not even rules and violating, like yourself, members, because you, again, if you violate, you have to answer to them eventually by fine. You need to have a presentation by them to say, okay, what kind of ship y'all running? Because here's the thing. One of y'all were very fortunate to challenge them, and I think it was back in early 2000s. Not Miguel, but the first Diaz-Lopatia, okay, who tried, okay, you know what I'm talking about. He tried to run fast, and he lost on his run. He would be with y'all here today, but he lost. But nevertheless, I'm trying to send you know, some of y'all knew what I'm talking about, which I forgot his first name. He challenged them in the 3rd District, and it brought out a lot of things that the FEC was not doing and what they were doing wrong. So when you talk about elections reform, let's go internally, too. The EFS system needs to be fixed so it's much easier for all to use who have to answer to it, or allow them to use file by paper and electronic form, or change it to a simple Microsoft a spreadsheet. Next thing is you need to deal with the FEC. I rarely ever have seen this body even deal with what does the FEC do and what are they doing and are they doing it right. I have never, for the years I've been here, ever seen them even give a presentation before any of the houses. Well, when you talk about elections reform, that's in it too. They're in it too. So with that, I'm going to close. And you deal with that. And for the record, as prior I spoke on the ethics. I have my packet here, and for the record, Chair and Representative Allen, I will now give you the proposal I have for the ethics. Okay. Thank you much. Good day.
If you'll give it to the staff, and unfortunately you missed it last week, Mr. Pitts, but we did have the Elections Commission in, so you could research that and probably find what they at least present to us. If you'll give it to, all right, just drop them here, and we'll be good. Thank you, sir. Any other public testimony that we didn't hear? Anybody else in the public that... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Edwards, did you have a question? I apologize.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to point out, you know, not all was lost in HB 1355, and it's very nice for people to get up here and point out all the weaknesses. But one of the questions that we asked very early on was whether or not it actually did its intended purpose in... weeding out fraud and abuse. And I just wanted to remind the public and our committee members that one of the issues was with the third-party registrations and that the federal government actually did come in and did an investigation that did. It's currently now under investigation helping find out cases of instances of abuse. So at least there was something positive that came out of it. I just wanted us to be aware of that and not always beat up on 1355 because there were a couple of good things that came out of it.
Thank you, Representative. We are not in debate. I know there's at least another member that would have loved to have debated that as well, but thank you for that comment. And there'll be plenty of time as we move forward. Well, I that wasn't directed at you. It was directed at somebody else that wanted to debate the issue.
Yeah, my boxing gloves ready.
But thank you, Representative Edwards, for those comments. Yes. No, that's good. You're fine. Okay. Any other public testimony? Seeing none, Representative Williams has asked Ms. Doss if you would indulge us. I think he has a question that came to mind since your presentation, if you wouldn't mind joining us again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You recognize Representative Williams.
She comes. You must have saw it on my face. I was ready to get my boxing gloves out for 1355, but I'll save that for another day on the floor. Mr. Doss, thank you for being here. Two quick questions that kind of I was trying to read through this memorandum that you gave us in the packet. And it came up, I think, a few meetings ago. About the ability to hold elected officials accountable. I know part of it would pertain to the Elections Commission, but I want to bring this back to the Ethics Commission. In your recommendations, and maybe it's in here, it's pretty comprehensive, is there anything in there that talks about individuals who are under ethics violations, holding them back from running for further office or, say, in our case, as House members, when we have to run every 2 years, people say, hold on, wait a minute, you didn't pay your ethics, you didn't resolve whatever the ethics complaint or what have you may be. Is there anything in there that will preclude them from running for retaining their office or running for another office?
You recognize Ms. Dawes?
No, sir, Representative, there is not. I have not researched the issue personally. I have been told by other attorneys that it would be unconstitutional to prohibit someone from running for public office based on a delinquent fine. There has been some conversation from different quarters about prohibiting people from being appointed or employed publicly. But I do not, and I think at one time, maybe last year, there was a bill or a draft of a bill that would have prohibited someone from running for office. But I think the general consensus has been that that would not pass constitutional muster. However, I have not researched it myself, so I can't guarantee that.
Thank you. Follow up? Yes, Representative Williams.
And if you can, and maybe through the chair, if you could provide whoever your legal scholars are that said it would be unconstitutional or get us the constitutionality component of this, because I think it's something that really gets a lot of folks upset, constituents and otherwise, and say, wow, this here's a guy or lady that has violated the law, but we're still allowing he or she to run for office. So if you could get that to us as we're doing this comprehensive review of our ethics and election laws, I think that would be very helpful. Maybe Mr. Chair may even require a PCB or a constitutional amendment that we put forth from this committee to address that or at least have the discussion. That was really a statement. My second question is, with this memorandum, this proposed legislation that you've given us, what's the fiscal impact? Have you put a fiscal impact on these proposed changes that you've given us?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
The
proposals that the commission has recommended in its package, we've estimated that there would not be a fiscal impact. We think that there would be somewhat increased workload because of the referrals, but we don't really anticipate that we're going to get a mountain of referrals coming down on us. We think it'll be, you know, in a fairly small neighborhood that could be absorbed by our current staff.
Thank you very much.
And one quick follow-up, sir.
Mr. Chair.
You may. Based on the investigation piece of it, where you said give you more investigative authority, you don't see at all having to bring on maybe one FTE or half an FTE to handle the further investigative workload that you are requesting?
Mr. Chair, at this time, we have not estimated that the volume would be that great as to require additional staff. If it happens and it turns out that we get, you know, 50 referrals in the next year from state attorneys and FDLE and whatever, then that may change. But just from what I've heard from the agencies out there that have sought our counsel on what cases the Ethics Commission might be able to take on, we haven't seen that it looks like there would be that volume of referrals that would necessitate more staff.
Thank you, Ms. Doss. Members, any other questions? Representative Hooper, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not necessarily a question of you. It's more of a ask of the committee. Since this committee began meeting, we've had a lot of discussion about length of ballot initiatives. And the argument is that ours are too long, and that may be the fact. In previous years, we've also had a lot of discussion that the 75-word limit is not enough. And I'm wondering if you, as the chair of this committee, have thought of any alternative suggestions or solutions, whether that's not to exceed 100 words or something that would be a reasonable compromise between our currently unlimited, which is too long, and explaining adequately a citizen-driven initiative restricted to 75 words or less. That may not quite be enough sometimes to appropriately explain the initiative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Hooper. And I wouldn't say the chair has come down with a definitive solution on it. We've heard a lot of testimony. I think we've got a lot of ideas. I think the committee's assignment over the coming weeks is going to be to filter through that and decide what is the best. And I think there is some, you know, personally, I believe there's some compromise that we can come to that will adequately address those concerns. But as far as figuring that out today, I don't think we have the answer, but I think we've had a lot of input as to where we need to go there. So I look forward to working with you and the others on the committee to establish that and accomplish that over the coming weeks. But very good point. I appreciate you bringing that up. Any other questions? Ms. Dawson, thank you so much for being here. Again, appreciate your presentation today and your willingness to stick around for questions. Okay, seeing no other questions, members, that brings us to the close of this meeting. We will be continuing our work in the weeks ahead, so be prepared. We're going to have some probably longer and a little more frequent meetings as we move ahead, but on a very, very important issue. So if there's no other questions, I appreciate your input and your participation today. And Ranking Member Cruz moves, we rise. With no objection, the meeting's adjourned.